You're listening to KBOO FM, Portland, KBOO Radio. Welcome to Talking Earth. My name is Sophia Hellstrom White, and with me tonight we are going to have a special reading and chatty interview with a wonderful Moira McAuliffe, and also known as MF McAuliffe. First of all, I'll start out doing the normal hosty things. And normally, Amanda's the one that is good at asking questions, and I'm not, but she's detained, so to speak. Not like in a cage, detained, but real life got in the way. Anyway, hello, Moira.
Hi. Hi, Sophia, and hi, everybody.
Yes, out to the magic of Radioland. Although this is pre-recorded Radioland, but... Patrick's telling me to be quiet.
Time travel radio land.
All right. Well, anyway, Moira has a new book out, and she's been doing promotions for it all about town and even in far-out realms like Gresham. And her book is called I'm Afraid of Americans. And tonight we'll be having her read from that and telling us a little about herself and her other side projects. And... she'll be talking about upcoming promotional events as well. So, Moira, first of all, this is my softball introductory question, is what was one of your big inspirations for writing this book?
Well, when I first came to the United States, it was the beginning of the 1980s, not long after Ronald Reagan had been elected president. And the first job I got was at the local high school near where we lived. And so when I walked onto campus, I was absolutely astonished because I found that it was and was not like the American high schools that we had seen on television.
Right.
First of all, there was the sheer size. There were 2,000 students, which was just amazing because... there would be perhaps 400 students at the normal South Australian suburban high school in Adelaide, where I came from. The next thing I noticed were the security guards, actual security guards in uniforms, though there were only two of them. I mean, it was just an absolute surprise. And then there were public telephones, as you would see on the street back in those days, for student use. So all of these things just struck me as you're not at home anymore. and the longer I stayed at the school, yes, the more I understood about it, but also the more I kept finding that this was a very different and large and complex country, and that I didn't understand very much at all about it. So I started writing about it, trying to make myself understand literally where I was and the kind of thing that was happening in front of me. And yes, it was like television in that, yes, the kids wore sneakers and they really were called freshmen, sophomores, juniors and seniors, which we certainly did not do. I mean, where I came from, there were first years, second years, third years, and fourth years. I mean, perhaps we lack imagination. I don't know.
No, Americans just like being put in little containers or little different compartments for everything. Yeah. So basically,
it was trying to understand, because it was so different from where I came from, just trying to understand what I was seeing and experiencing.
Okay, then. I totally get that. I mean, I was born here, and it's like, I'm still not sure I get that. I get it. So would you like to read a section of it now?
Well, certainly.
Wonderful.
The first position I had at the high school was as an attendance clerk in the attendance office. And... again, because of the size of the school, as far as I know, this is not the way it was run where I grew up. I never saw such a thing, and I did work in schools in South Australia for a while. So does everybody know what an attendance office is? I mean, would...
Let's just say no.
Okay. So this was the office where there were four clerks and four windows, and a bench ran along under the windows, and next to each window there was a time clock. And kids who had been absent and had brought notes from their parents explaining their absences would come to the window, present the note, we would timestamp it in said time clock, and issue them a permit back into classes. And we'd date that and initial it.
Yeah, that wasn't the office I spent the most time in.
I made up for it. Okay. I spent a lot of time in that one.
Okay, well.
So, this is the attendance office. Here in the South Bay, where Julius Sumner Miller once taught at El Camino Community College, and Thomas Pynchon was once an assistant, where John Steinbeck once lived in a small stucco house on the seedier edge of El Segundo. Here in the South Bay, all that's gone now, except El Camino Community College, gone with the bean and strawberry fields that stretched down from the southern edge of LA during the Depression and World War II. Here in the attendance office at Greenlawn High, in the filing system, there are names from all over the world. Soshil is Aztec. Godabu is Indian. Bolat is Burmese. Shamsuddin, Abu Tahir, Atir, Azam, Azim, Gonzalez, Garcia, Alatorre, Zuniga, Zoigan, Zak, Zeladon, Fatima, Kalila, Isis. There are new black names. Lawana, Lavonia, Lashon, Dewana, Donita, Shonea, La Rochelle. Old names. Prometheus, Theophilus, Hector. Greece, Troy, Byzantium. Old Christian Spain expels the Moors and the Jews and annexes the Americas. Asuncion, Trinidad, Salvador, Diego. The skeins of the world flow through my fingers, crisscrossing, combining. The parents speak Viet or Farsi. The kids speak Viet or Farsi and English. The kids who help with the filing ask, is Jim the same as James? Is Bill William? Is Pedro Peter? Is it Scott Renford or Renford Scott? Jorge Alborges, 14 years old, born in Buenos Aires, files notes in the folder of Marlo Marquez, 16 years old, born in Guadalajara. I smile. Bright skeins, then, now, there, here. Here, Los Angeles, 1983. Post-Christ, post-Watts, pre-Pleistocene, pre-apocalypse. I file the notes from the parents from everywhere. Notes for Christy, notes for Tony, notes excusing absences for Rusty, Happy, Laurie, Tina. All the skeins are weaving, time and the world. The kids say, Christy's not the same as Tina. The pre-apocalypse day glitters through the Venetians. Water glitters on the canals of Venice, the Mediterranean bright with Phoenician ships. Sidon, Tyre, Israel. All the Mediterranean's strident, struggling history is present in these words. Yes, I say. It is Christ, Christian, Christine. No, they say, look. There are two folders, one for each twin, one for Christy, one for Tina. And suddenly I wonder if the skeins are only snippets, if the snippets are only scraps, if scraps can recombine. This is all Falcon and the Snowman country, 16 blocks from the sea, 30 blocks from the TRW complex with its CIA twin-tish satellite downlink, 25 blocks from Hughes Aircraft, 20 blocks from McDonnell Douglas, 16 blocks from Northrop, 12 blocks from Hughes Satellite, 10 blocks from the United States Air Force Space Division. This is a Cold War nuclear bullseye. Cold creeps along my arms. All is making and unmaking. Nothing is stable here.
Wow. Thank you, Moira.
You're welcome.
That's one of the things I love about your writing, whether it's poetry or your prose, is how you can get into all the classical references while you're also reading about something at a specific time that's not classical. And I must admit, I haven't read the book yet, but I assume it dips into that territory fairly often. In your prose, in your narrative. how you can
reference
this
one is not particularly concerned with ancient history.
Although you do make a few references, like in that chapter, and sort of your flow. Sorry.
Well, perhaps sometimes I do. This one was concerned very much with the time when I was there, which was during during the early 1980s.
Yes.
In fact, into the early 90s.
Right.
Oh. And what I was explaining to myself essentially was how in everyday life the really big conflicts in the world. This was the height of the Cold War. Reagan had just become president. And how all this sort of folded into that immediately and without any buffer at all. There was no 7,000 miles of ocean. There was no thickness of the earth between us and everything else anymore. I'd moved.
I've always been fascinated hearing the stories about it because, you know, there's official news reports and nostalgia, and then there's the people I know that actually lived through that period. I mean, I was born like 4 days after Reagan was elected, so I only know so much personal experience, but not to date anyone in this room, but it was like, you know, it's not that I like being scared of things, but it's like knowing that I was there and stuff and people were genuinely worried and when I was talking about classical references, I didn't mean to say you were talking about classical things. You were just in your flow.
Sometimes I do that.
So I'm trying to sound smart now. I'm winning at that. But brief shout in. When I'm delaying on something, you will hear the official voice of God, which is Patrick Bocard.
Is that so?
That is so. He sometimes chimes in.
The voice of God doesn't know anything.
That's what I thought reading the book. Anyway, but speaking of books, Moira, are you ready for another section yet?
Well, to kind of illustrate what I've just been talking about, I can read a short piece called "The Cohort of Mist, Fog, and Fire." And it's also from 1983.
Okay.
Wade walked the thick, black, cold hell roar. Oh, God, move, phosphorus, burning meat mist. The mist would lie all along the trees in the mornings. Anything could be inside there in the shadows and the dark. You were out in the open. The only thing to do was keep moving. Mortar takes out 2-3 guys at once. So you keep moving and watching. Praying that goddamn mist will burn off. For a while after I came back, I'd wake up rigid with terror, sweating, drenched in sweat. I'd just lie there, paralyzed. Booming burn. I never could sleep. Even at my grandmother's house, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and lie there awake while the floorboards creaked. I get here at 5:15. That early, the fog just swallows the campus. I go to my room and I get stuff ready to duplicate. Aristotle, an essay on cause, maybe, or effect, then an essay on cause and effect. We start the literature section with morality and fiction. I ask the kids about their lives, and then we do the tragedies, Oedipus, Antigone. After class, I do a little tutoring, work out extra reading for the really bright kids. If a kid is failing, I'll go visit the family and find out what the problem is. The great thing is to take it as it comes. Keep your dignity. Keep your integrity. The army's the greatest teacher in the world. There's only one answer for any question, and you learn that answer because your life depends on it. I used to dance a lot, hit the clubs. I loved dancing, but I haven't been able since I got back. Too much surgery. My wife likes to go out to dinner, so we go out pretty much every night. After that, I read till 1, 2, sleep a little, and then come into school. That early, the fog just swallows the campus. Sometimes around the middle of the day, sun starts to burn through, and it's this greyed and flailing thing twitching in the last of the fog, trapped up there, dim and pitted and guttering. It's nothing. It's just a ghost up there, half the colour of the moon. My wife wants a kid and she's leaving me. And the moon is the fog and the fog smells of the stinking rot when you wade walk the thick.
That feels like a pretty good summation of the mood of the time. I mean, my parents at the time were thrilled because they were into the world types, but you know, and they were just perpetually disappointed as time went on. So to ask something about the profession in the book, it was like, what would you generally say was the issue behind the kids who were not doing as well? Or,
well,
probably
this particular area was close to LAX, Los Angeles International Airport.
Sure.
And parts of the area were extremely poor.
Right.
It was a major immigration point.
Yeah.
And as in a lot of poor areas, what realtors like to describe as the housing stock is also very poor.
Sure.
And in fact, we have a story about that.
Okay. I can't
about
wait.
That. It's called Oliver. It's also 1983. Oliver comes from Cuba and stands at the back of the room, taller than the younger kids in the class, too full of energy to sit. It's time for the flag salute. Afterwards, the teacher asks how long the president is in office. Kids put their hands up. She smiles. And in Cuba? Para la vida! Oliver shouts, legs apart, possessing the unbroken wooden floor. He comes from Cuba and is proud of it, hates the way the Americans hate his country when they're clearly inferior, and the place they've given him to live, rat holes and murder, so clearly resembles shit.
<That's>
What's the translation of the Spanish?
Oh, for life.
For life, yeah.
Should I not?
Oh, no. Because you're freaking hard out. It's fine. Yeah, that was a good way to answer my questions. That was,
There's another one along here. Oh. When I had a different job, I was the library clerk later on. Rogelio. Rogelio wears dashing red and sea blue Hawaiian shirts and is a sophomore. He prances in, compact and muscled, twisting and laughing, spiky-haired lively, on the verge of being rambunctious, but not impolite. His English is a bit fractured. Today he's lost his book, he says, as he dances past a table and plant into the far body of the room. Where do you think it is? I don't know. Here, there, maybe in the moon. Buscalo en la luna, pues. He turns and laughs, laughs past the desk, laughs past the doors and outside, the red fish on his shirt flashing with energy. He flexes in, compact and muscled, spiky-haired. I ask how he is. He says he's leaving school at the end of the semester. Without a qualification, I think. My family's going back to El Salvador. Will you be able to go to school? He shrugs and looks at the floor a second. I've never seen him lower his eyes. I've never seen him still. I will be in the army. When you're 18, you go into the army. When will you be 18? He hesitates as though this requires calculation. Perhaps it does, I think. The records could be missing, lost in the move. There mightn't have been any records, anything they could get hold of, get copies of. In July.
So, anything stand out from that period of your life? Well, I mean, well, it's obviously since you made a book out of it. Oh, I am not good at questioning today, but I'm trying to be. Would you like to read some more from that period, or what are you feeling most tonight? Because I assume, like, when you've been doing the live shows, it's...
Well, normally I read from this section of the book because it's the one with the title story, of course. And it's the one that I thought people would be most interested in because the second section of the book is a series of stories set in Australia, which I thought would probably be less interesting to people.
No. It's less interesting to you because you're Australian.
Okay.
It's like, you know, it's like I'm an American, so I'm surrounded by America crap all the time. So, oh, I mean, right. It's all interesting. But.
These tend to be longer. Let me see. I can read at least part of this one, if you like.
Sure, absolutely.
It's set in Australia, in South Australia, in 1969. And it's called Warner. Well, the events it speaks of took set in 1969. This isn't the Warner Gilchrist who's a neurosurgeon, nor the Warner Gilchrist who's a bell ringer, nor the Warner Gilchrist who's an executive lawyer, nor the Warner Gilchrist who's a male model, but the Warner Gilchrist whose bone and residue in a closed coffin in one of Adelaide's cemeteries. His father was James Gilchrist, a local columnist for The Examiner and one of the most fatuous writers I've ever read. At 15, my rage at his column was boundless. Churchgoers and rosegrowers' regard for him was likewise boundless. Now even Google can't find him. Warner was his firstborn, a rat-faced, slit-eyed bounce ball of self-regard. He wasn't tall, he wasn't lithe, but he walked as though he was. I knew a lot about the way he walked. He walked in late, down the full length of the theatre every time we had an English lecture. He was as full of crap as his father, and as well regarded. He was very young, they said. There was a law that you had to be 17 to go to uni, otherwise you had to petition the governor. I'd come within 2 months of having to petition. He'd come within 2 weeks. I didn't know his name. I knew the orange hair and freckles, the stretchy dacked slouch, the eyes, his lack of folder as he slouched past the front rows of girls busy writing in theirs. I knew he bounced a tennis ball across the plaza month in and month out. I saw him from the library windows. He never seemed to do any work. I expected him to fail. At the end of the year, I came third. Someone called Warner Gilchrist had come second. Walter Salim, a thin, pale worm, had come first. In second year, Orange Boy still had the ball, mostly in his pocket. Early in third year, the student newspaper revived. Someone called Warner Gilchrist, with friends, ran it. Warner was the editor. Van Hulse, a friend of mine, gaunt and haunted flame of a boy, went off and politicked. When he came back, we were the joint literary editor. Oh, I said. Not only that, Warner Gilchrist was the son of James Gilchrist. As we all waited at the entrance to the large theatre, I could see the darkened study of his late nights with his father, typewriter table, pool of light, whiskey to whiskey, man to man, help with homework, help. Did his father help him say the things I wanted to say? The feeling at the tip of the branch when the grapevines are pruned, how the small grey wind came from the gullies, how the scatter and spray and spew of the houses lay between the hills and the sea. He'd had help, had it for years and years and years. This means we can be a power on campus. Van Hulse was glowing, his lips open with hope. I had pressing problems. Lose your scholarship and where are you going to get the money problems. The entire Spanish Renaissance in Renaissance Spanish problems. Norse sagas in Old Norse problems and Beowulf in ornamented Anglo-Saxon problems. Where did Warner get all his free time? I said. Hulse invented projects and cajoled students far and wide. I talked a couple of submissions out of a couple of staff. I had too much work to help him much. Warner's articles began to appear. Sex and the Pill and the New Gloriousness of Life, the Hey Jude review, the penis piece, a four-pager on the true humanity of not regarding your penis as a free strap-on gift offer, was something his father might have written if he hadn't been addressing the middle-aged middle class. Dear Warner, I have never regarded my penis as a free strap-on gift offer. Love, Veronica. Did not get printed. Around the same time, Hulse told me that nothing we were digging up was getting printed either. Take it up with the student union executive. Hulse, white-faced with anger. The paper wasn't controlled by the union. The press was owned by a consortium of Warner and his friends. So, his father had bought him a fake newspaper for a platform and a press to print it on. And it goes on from there.
Oh, that I could associate that image with so many poets I know. Not the name names, but...
Here's a nice one. It's got a nice ending, and it's not very long at all. We are afraid back in the United States. We can visit Australia again afterwards.
Okay. I'm just going to say, you would do a better job at picking what you would want to read, so I'll let you take control for a little bit. So, just because, you know, okay. You know you better than I do.
Yes, I have to live with me.
I would do great at interviewing me, but anybody else...
So this one's called Herbert's Legacy, and this is set in the high school library. Daylight draining quietly from the windows above the bookshelves. Mr. Lewis standing behind the tables his students are spreading around. Black raincoat, silver hair, tanned face. English teacher. This group is his science fiction elective. He has two young teenage boys. His wife is American Indian. She works part-time. Rain colliding softly with the clear flat panes above the books. The doors to the patio closed against the water. The room is quiet. Mr. Lewis, will you be here for the next 10 minutes? This high school, built for 2,000 students, now houses 3,200. The library can't be left unsupervised, neither can the kids. He looks up from the table and the kids reading, realises I've spoken and what I've said. Oh, yeah. Because I'd like to zip off and have a cup of tea. Oh, sure. His face tanned, inexpressive. Did you know Frank Herbert died? Oh, yeah. I heard it on the news last night. Ah. I'd heard it the morning before. I wanted to be the first to tell him for some reason. Wanted news to impart that would matter to both of us. For 2 days, Frank Herbert's death hadn't mattered to anyone I'd spoken to. It was cancer. No response. It was so sudden. My voice trembling like my mother's, though I hadn't intended it to. His glasses catching the colour of the windows. Yes, he said. He didn't say anything else. I went on break. Mm. As classes leave the library on late spring mornings, late summer mornings, Indian summer mornings before the heat begins to fade, I watch the opaque green leaves of the wandering pear in the patio as they lie against the sky and think of the leaves I used to look at. Apple, orange, almond, walnut, locust, Moreton Bay fig. Mysteries of opacity, the sky refusing to shine through them when something so clear and intense and pure should clearly be able to pass through anything. I stare at the wandering pear the librarian planted 20 years ago, trying to coerce its leaves through time and space until they become the leaves I knew, trying to absorb the extent of the Atlantic on the library's globe, swallow it until it appears and disappears and the ocean closes and land joins land. So that when I say someone significant has died, no one will first comment on my accent or ask me to repeat myself, so that the matter under discussion won't be the odd foreign concern of the odd foreign clerk, but a matter of common interest, a pillar of the common world falling. Chingo, motherfucker, push. Here they put the shit, shove. Me back from the break and across the room in a split second. Lewis writing detention slips, same two kids every time. I suspect they can't read well enough to be in this group. I've opened one of the doors to the descending grey day. The spatter from the overhang is slowing. No new drops slanting, blown sideways, concussed on the windows. The class is leaving. Me stamping due dates, kids snatching books from under the stamp, kid tearing the date juice slip out of the book altogether. Hey, stop that! Me, loud angry, my voice sounding like my father's, though I hadn't intended it to. Lewis pulling the kid aside to bring the book back for taping. Me telling another kid he has to go get Mr. Lewis's permission, nodding towards Mr. Lewis to reinforce the idea, slightly emphasising the Mr. so the kid remembers. Mr. Lewis is a teacher. All the support staff have been told to call teachers Mr., Mrs. or Miss. A mark of respect, of difference, as a reminder to the kids that teachers have authority. They're above us. Last book checked out, I move to the door to speed the process along. Kids to their next class, Lewis to his, checking date due slips as the last kids filter past. Then Lewis looks up as he turns to move towards the rest of the campus. Why don't you call me Simon? The librarian planted the pear to create shade so kids could sit and read or study at the tables on the patio. The tables have gone. the pears brutally cut back every summer. The librarian now serves every school in the district and is hardly ever here. I watch the back of Lewis's black raincoat, the coat his wife has so clearly bought him because it will go so well with his hair now that his hair's turning silver. His Amerindian wife. I think about Lewis turning and turning again and seeing the girl.
I'm going to have to buy this soon. I mean, obviously. Which I suggest everyone who's listening to this buy her books. Which, where are they available? I figured now's a good time to do some promotion.
They're available at Powell's Downtown in the small press section. They're available at Mother Foucault's bookshop. They're available at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. And I think they're available at another read-through.
And because this recording is playing in the future, as in third Monday of August, you will be promoting a reading of your own that's happening in Mother Foucault's.
On the Mother Foucault's reading has happened, but I'll be reading at Ford Food Service on 11th and Division on the 7th of September at 6 o'clock. So that's a Saturday. So early Saturday evening. 7th of September, Ford Food Service. I'll be reading from this book and there will be copies to sell if you feel so moved. And if you need more time to think about it, they're also available directly from our website, gobshitequarterly.com. There's a picture on the front page. You click on the picture.
Awesome. That's one of the best innovations of the internet. It's like you have to... You don't have to think as much. You're like, picture, I want that. It's just,
yes.
So, if you'd like to read another piece,
you want,
or a section. Or,
okay. Let me see. Oh. I would like to read the prologue because I have never read it at a live reading because it seemed slightly beside the point, but it does open the book. So it's called Bahram Gur Goes Hunting. Once upon a time, just by the entranceway to the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne, there were three Persian miniatures encased in glass. The most beautiful of these was called Bahram Gur Hunting. The sky was a gorgeous bowl inlaid with curved gold and silver clouds. Bahram Gur in his chariot, preceded by hounds, trailed by retainers, pursued a deer. Little trees stood on nearby hills, leaves like curved round bowls, like the clouds solidified. Between hunts, Bahram Gur's retainers kept track of the land, the trees, the deer, kept them in number and place. The world waited for Bahram Gur, his inlaid chariot, his bows and arrows and dogs, his wealth and power and terror. And when Bahram Gur went hunting, the world was a deep and shining jewel.
I guess that's the other function of this show. It's like, since you focus on certain pieces when you're reading live, it's like this is the place where you read the stuff you might feel is underrated, if you like, or as far as live performance. Not,
I mean, yeah.
If you want.
it's important that it be at the beginning of the book, and yeah. I was assuming that people, because the... This title, the first half of the book is a sequence. I assumed that people would read it first, and it sets a frame.
Right.
The first story in the book is actually called Morning, and again it's set in 1983. It must be 7:30. The old fucker's in the rearview mirror, shuffling down the other side of the street. If you can call frail shoving with a walker some kind of shuffle. Two squeaky wheels in front, just the frame behind. Squeak, scrape. Go stop. Scrawny arms, Salvation Army shirt on some other fucker's already worn. There might be money in his pocket. Hard to say. Legs stiff. He pushes like they're wood or something. Scrawny tendons. skinny legs, strings. White hair, all limp, bald in the middle. Old hair. 7:30. Time for me to slam the car door and walk across campus. My legs are moving more like wood now. Knees going out. Hair's short, bald on top. Moustache starts on my lip but grows and curls halfway across my cheeks, white as the surf was in Malibu, Laguna Niguel. All that bright white water, all that bright hair, all the beer and the girls. We were gods on our way to the moon, and gods. Mornings. Nip in them now, jacket weather. Been here 35 years. 35 years teaching world history. Junior basketball coach. Still coaching basketball. 2 more years I can retire, move down the coast, maybe get a place in Mexico. Warm all year round in Mexico. Old fuckers turning. Goes squeak stopping on the long mat, waiting for the door. Warmer in Safeway. He'll stay there an hour, maybe two. Fall coming on. Jacket weather.
I love that. Well, so now's the good time. Now's a good time for me to ask about something I'm always curious about, and that's the writing process for our guest. And I've wondered that for years, but, you know, now that I'm a radio show host, it's easier for me to walk up this, you know, I can ask questions I couldn't ask by just randomly walk up to somebody like, how do you write? So anyway, how do you write?
Well, fairly slowly by the look of it. When I was a kid, my parents would often talk about moving, but they would never actually do it, and I was very relieved, actually, to, though I wasn't, you know, consulted in any real way, I was always relieved when they decided not to. But it seems that, you know, as soon as I left college, I've done nothing but move. And particularly since I came to the United States, moving has ultimately meant losing track of manuscripts for quite some time. There was a long poem I had that I started in 75 and went on with in 81, and I put it away carefully because I liked it. And I saw it in 82 in Lawndale, and again I put it away carefully because I liked it. It was on fool's cap, so, you know, it didn't fit any filing cabinet or any folder in the country. And then, you know, some years later I was thinking, you know, what happened to that? I wouldn't have thrown it away because I liked it. And so we finally moved to Portland in 92, and I was sorting through, you know, the large black bags that, you know, we'd had the resort to get out in time, and the drawers and so forth. And I found it. I was so pleased. I was so happy. So I went on with it in late 92 and finished it very early in 93. So that one had been written over, you know, nearly 20 years, mostly because I literally lost track of it for, you know,
some time.
Quite some time. And then these I lost track of. I made notes at the time, but I always intended to get back to them and, you know, make a collection out of them. And for some reason, I put them in a box instead of into my filing cabinet. And I'd look through my filing cabinet, think, I know, there used to be more in here. I know they did. So one day, when I was one Christmas, I was going through the closet, deciding to throw out things that I no longer needed. And I found these folders. And so, oh, goody, you know. And so here we are, we have a book. But I think the space then was, again, you know, that was about 10 years that I'd lost track of them at that point. So that's one of the things that happens. And that, I don't know exactly what that explains, but it explains something.
And it sort of explains. Did you feel a new joy from, like, reading them after having not read them for a while?
What I found was a great deal of relief, because most of them needed almost no editing. They were almost there, and I hadn't been able to see it at the time. So that helped. But you know, I also had to make some connective tissue, write some new things. And if I was going to do it as a sequence, I needed to round out a few more things, supply a few more things to make it flow properly. And that was actually quite easy. It was easier than I expected it to be.
That's a relief when that happens.
It is.
I can remember recently looking at some of the stuff I wrote in the early 2000s, and I'll say it wasn't as much of a relief that I had it flashed in front of me. So I'm envious. And
part of it also is time. Yeah. Where I used to work, there was a budget crunch at one point, and I couldn't take on extra hours, so I could only work my assigned hours, which left me time, and that was when I wrote a novella. So time is part of it. I tend to write in very short bursts, or just jot things down in a notebook as I'm passing, and so that's why so many of my things are so short. But that's just kind of
they
the
really
way it's
merge
worked.
Well together, though.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm glad that the flow is sort of becoming apparent.
It is, and you're excellent at putting together connective tissue. So would you like to read another couple of pieces?
Okay. This one is set in Australia. It's called Woman in Staff Room, Woman in Corridor. He was gentle. Because he was gentle and she knew him, because he'd cried when his wife left him, because he loved his kids. Because he'd cried and been stricken, because he was lost and had cried, because he was gentle and laughed and loved his children. Because they'd walked and half laughed along the riverbank and walked and half listened along the street, because he wanted and she thought she could give him something, enough over lunch, over dinner, while he was lost. Because he asked and she couldn't say no, because she agreed to dinner in the staff dining room. It was handy. She was a contract staff, and so she'd never been there. She had never bothered to go. He had to stay for a class at 5:30. The student cafeteria was downstairs, along the side street, a long string of a room, orange vinyl under a black wooden ceiling. The vinyl was adrift in squalor. The squalor was encrusted with noise. The staff dining room was upstairs and along the highway, a long, blue-carpeted room, maple tables, heavy beige Hessian curtains. The light was muted. The air was muted. She watched the curtains hang, block out traffic, commuting, blackboards, chalk, diagrams, work, morning, evening, coming, going, home, work, layoff, fury, fear. There were four older men eating without much sound at a few isolated tables. She was alone, morning, evening, coming, going. She was early. Chalk, blackboard, layoff. She was by herself. Fear, fear, fury. The blue carpeted space waited for sound. The men's eyes waited for news. Everyone knew everyone. Only old timers ate up here. She was news that would be alluded to. These men would see and surmise, shake their heads, smirk, shrug. She turned to leave. Laid off. Fury, fear, fear. He arrived. He smiled at her, blushed, and said how glad he was she could make it, how he'd looked forward to it. She was his guest. He ushered her over to the centre table, held a chair, gave her the menu with a flourish, told her how his kids had taken to her when they'd all had dinner after the walk along the river, how they'd asked when she'd come back. She smiled and asked if the vegetables were frozen, so he'd stop being so direct, so pleased, so loud, so voluble, because the last of the sunlight was glinting through the chinks in the curtains and she could see how dusty the air was, how the old men were and how they'd fought over the years from the time the college had been a smithy and lunch had been in an open shed, how they'd furnished their classrooms out of estate sales, how they'd sharpened their pencils with their teeth, how they'd hung their metal grey coats in grey metal cupboards while the rain and the years and the nights pelted down, how they'd fought and gradually things had got better, a staff association, a dining room, how their fingers and thumbs had been ingrained with chalk and still were and would be even after they stopped lecturing, how the heaviness of their heads and gazes was age as much as armature, how they could see her as a bright parrot-like frivolity, another one of the endless pretty women who came and went in the endlessly frivolous arts department, how they'd watch other men take women like her to dinner and somewhere else afterwards if they didn't themselves, those women who probably shouldn't have been there and who certainly wouldn't be in another 30 years because they'd never been in it for the long haul. Never would be. He was looking at her and telling her about his lecture. He was looking at her and his eyes were wide with trust and his hands were small and neat, too small to fend off a blow, far too small to strike one. She had to leave. She was desperate to leave because he was trusting and alone and his kids had taken to her, because she had nothing to say and nothing to give, because the place was being closed and everyone was being laid off, old-timers and all, because his severance would be large and he was generous, because he loved his kids, because he was gentle. She smiled and declined dessert. She smiled and thanked him and said she had to go. He offered to walk her to her car. She stood up. The foot of the chair caught on the carpet. The edge of the tablecloth rose with her. The coffee spilt, the heavy silverware fell against the plates. Every head turned. The old man's eyes looked at her, saw a wisp. His eyes returned to her, saw earth and hearth and warmth, when all she'd wanted was an unobtrusive exit. He helped as she gathered books and papers from her office for the evening's work. She closed and locked the office door. It was the office, she thought, not hers. It was less transient than she was. They walked down the corridor. He was waiting. Small hands, generosity, smile. He loved his kids, wanted someone decent for them. What about next Saturday? She'd been dreading this because she knew him and liked him and he had been hurt, because walking along the river had been too much, was in it for the long haul. She wanted to hide, stop existing, because the only thing she could say now would leave him alone in a landscape of loss where he was gentle and loved his kids and was still crying.
Okay, and now we are going to bring in someone who was patiently waiting silently. RV, who is one of your co-conspirators on your publishing empire, as we could call it that. So hello, RV.
Hello. I'm a founder and editor of Dropshot Quarterly and Reprobate Books. We've done several books under Reprobate. Moira's edited two of the projects. I've edited the others. We've published Brenda Taube's The Art of Waking Up, Breakfast 43 Poems by Coleman Stevens, and Douglas Spangle's White Concrete Day, and most recently the Winter Spring 2019 Gobshite Quarterly. We're on hiatus until the next winter spring for all sorts of reasons. And also I'm applying for grants and I'm working on personal projects, including having recently published, and we're launching them. I have two short story collections of my own. And so that is requiring some effort because each of them is around, well, one of them is 355 pages and the other one's 375 pages. So that's a lot of writing, and I'm getting those. A small press in Southern California is dealing with those.
So both of you are staying busy.
Yes, and I'm doing a lot of translation, and again, grants. So that keeps me fairly occupied.
Okay. If you would like, would you like to read something out of one of the upcoming gubshites? If you'd like to read
Well, as recent, we don't have an upcoming.
Or a recent, I'm sorry,
yeah,
pardon
that's
me.
Okay. What would we want to read, something by a Portland writer, or?
Whatever works for you, RV.
Okay, I can read a piece.
Okay, no epic, because you're the guest star.
I understand. It's short. It's short. By Poe Ballantyne, who resides in Nebraska. And it's a tasty little piece. I'm going to read it rather than reading it in Icelandic or in Croatian or Spanish. I'm going to read it in English. In memory of Fancy Pants McTail. The leper cheerleader, Harriet Hansen, hopped on the sidelines in a tattered tutu, diaphanous in the fog, slightly decrepit, but the rose of youth still in her cheeks. She appeared to move on only one leg and smiled at me as I was pasted by the giant right tackle, who smelled of worms and multiple vitamins and mold. We beat the lepers that day, 98-9. Many players were taken off in stretchers, never to return. But when the bus left, I stayed. The lepers were famous for their parties. The dank halls of St. Augustine Abandoned Catholic High School teemed with limping figures, crumbling altar boys, the homesick banging heads against locker doors, scarred emos groping in dark corners, disheveled nuns with peripheral nerve damage, pulling bell cords and staring into broken mirrors. Votech dropouts massaging their nodules. Harriet Hansen and I made love in the press box under a torn poster of the legendary Fancy Pants McTail. And you know that saying, once you go Mycobacterium leprae, you can never come back. But I have no regrets. What cause is greater than love? All of us who come to stay at St. Augustine's are one. Common in our decay. There are no cliques here, no hierarchies, no bigotries. There is only the lonesome and sublime ballet of leprosy. Every Friday, we watch the games from the press box in the spectral mummy-smelling rain, bodies thumping against damp loam, the air draped with drifting sheets of dermis. Sometimes it seems as if the great Fancy Pants McTeo himself has returned, giving the victorious leper sign, four or three fingers, depending. Smashing through the lines, saluting the crowd military style, kicking the ball up into the stand, his foot or his shoe, who can tell? Tumbling afterwards, the redolent scent of Band-Aids floating through the mist. There's a note on the Icelandic translation. The proper name Band-Aids, if not referring to the actual company or product name, can thusly be translated as plastrar. And now you know.
I would say that like three of the four of us were trying hard to not fill the room with laughter there.
I thought it was so inappropriate. It was such a marvelous bit of Beckettian tragedy.
Well, that begets humor.
Worthy of Steinbeck at its most lugubrious.
Anyway.
Should I pilot hire her?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you, R.V. Branham. And,
And this is another one set in the high school. It's called Therapy. Therapy. Saturday nights, after dark, Shabbat still in the body rhythm, even after all these years. And bodies end up in the front of the 32-inch behemoth thighs, mouth caverns stuffed with cock. Then there are 15 or 20 of us on or around the bed and room, in and out. I cop a stray hand or two, anybody's, I don't care. Sometimes you hear the railroad a few blocks from here, sometimes not. Saturday nights, partying down, booze and coke and porn, Freudian trains. Sunday mornings. I finally figured Sunday mornings. The home office is upstairs. Sunday mornings I work the office. Saturday night is why so many people want therapy Sunday morning. They sit in front of the sky blue window and ask me to cop a feel of their psyches. Intangible as depth of field. So I hold up mirrors. See through yourself. See right through to the bright blind sky. I make 15, 20 a year out of Sunday morning, holding up mirrors, telling them exactly what they've told me. Reality therapy. I'm everybody's father. They come to me for permission. I give them what they give me. They give themselves permission, eventually. When they do, they leave. That's it. Finished. Cured. Stumble down. She looks at me. I look at her, dark and tangible. She gets off the bus. I get off. I follow her hour-long, mind-long, body-long sweetness to multicolored concrete and cloth and rust. She turns, looks me in the eye. Mon, she says, Visa or MasterCard? I hand her the whole wallet, and then my trash bag of a body, my own tumble down, leaves me speech and bloodless. Saturdays, Sundays, booze, coke, corn, trash bags, weed. New semesters, new faces. Am I okay? Will I be okay? Am I a dyke? Am I gay? Am I going to hell? You don't go to hell, kid. It comes to you out of the trees at heaven's door.
Well, thank you. Oh, the term reality therapy, because, you know, reality is the number one cause of therapy. Well, this has been a great interview. Thank you, Moira McAuliffe.
Well, thank you very much, Sophia. And Patrick, of course, for recording. Nice. And thank you, RB, for...
I was about to thank him for...
I'm welcome.
Good. Yes, you are. You have been welcome all
and
along.
Thank you, Sophia. Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. And
yes. Thank you, RB, for giving us some guilty laughter.
Thank you for the listeners of KBOO and fabulous Reykjavik, or is it Little Beirut?
It's Portland, last I heard.
Little Beirut, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That works.
And you can hear different things from I'm Afraid of Americans at Ford Food Service, 11th and Division, on September the 7th at 6 p.m. They are expecting you.
Yes, go to that. And thank you, everyone. Have a good night.